This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost here with you on DAB online and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until midday, sharing ideas about money. I'm joined in the studio by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss from the award-winning This Is Money to talk through some of the top stories on their website that they've been investigating over the last 7 days. And on the agenda today, crisis. What crisis? Big banks pay out billions in bonuses and dividends despite the rocky start to the year and fall in profits. HSBC, Lloyds and RBS this week.
These numbers have come out at a critical time. We've seen banking stocks very weak. Lloyds Bank surprised the market with the strength and the resilience of their numbers.
Is it time to start thinking about a summer staycation as Brexit fears push the pound to its lowest level against the euro for more than a year? Also today, as we gear up for the Chancellor's budget, fears are increasing over what it'll do with our pensions.
Pensions are not a benefit, they are a right. One of my constituents described them as a contract, and that's exactly what they are.
We take a look at the options on the table and the potential impacts. Also, we take a look at rising house prices.
The market's certainly very cyclical, and we do see these big swings in house prices, but we don't see much evidence of there being any sort of long-term narrowing in the north-south divide.
Well, Santander reckon they could double in 15 years. If that's not bad enough, we're hearing more examples of mortgage ageism and the woes of second steppers. Also today, fancy a nice little cash windfall? Well, we'll reveal the 14 organisations that could owe you money and, importantly, how you can claim it. And we reveal the secret way to get discount codes when shopping online, which got me thinking on that theme. I want to know today, are you a voucher enthusiast or is it all a ruse to get you to buy stuff you don't really want and you end up with quite literally a load of rubbish in your wallet or at the bottom of your handbag? On that note, a very warm welcome, editor Simon Lambert, a warm welcome, Rachel Rickard-Strauss, to the studio. I'm going to start with Rachel this morning, if that's all right, because I did mention handbags there. Are you a voucher enthusiast?
No, I'm embarrassed to say. I really pick and choose around all this money-saving stuff. When I can't be bothered to do it, then I justify it on privacy grounds. I don't sign up to any loyalty schemes or anything like that because I don't want them having all of that data on me. But then I'm quite happy to give away my data when I feel like it, when it's in my interest. So I do use Top Cashback and have about 150 quid back from them in the last year. So
that's not
to
bad.
Me, that feels justified.
Simon, I'm going to ask you, but I think I already know the answer. A voucher enthusiast?
No.
Shock, horror.
I know. Last week I said that life was too short for reward points and loyalty cards. Life is also too short for voucher hounding. I am definitely not an extreme couponer. I do like a discount, don't get me wrong. And I do like it sometimes when I get something sent something by a retailer for a discount for something I might buy regularly. Maybe I get that actually properly targeted email or something from somewhere I've bought stuff regularly. But no, I'm not really interested in vouchers. And whenever I have them, I always basically forget to spend them before they run out anyway. I think they're just a way of trying to make people buy stuff they wouldn't buy in the first place.
Share Radio has great news. We're going national in March 2016, so you'll be able to hear your favourite programmes on digital across the UK. And to listen on the move, just download one of our latest apps. Our new iPad app includes a fantastic and very fast Listen Again feature. And with our newly upgraded mobile phone app, you can listen live wherever you are. Share Radio is going national on the new D2 digital network in March 2016.
It is indeed all very excited about that. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio. I'm here every weekday between 9 and midday. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, are in the studio for their weekly catch-up, running through some of the stories they've been looking at over the last 7 days. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert, a personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And coming up, bank profits are down, shares all over the shop. Dividends, though, are up. How do you square that circle? But first, bad news for holidaymakers planning on a European break, perhaps this Easter or this summer. This week, we saw the pound fall to lows not seen for almost 7 years. What's it down to? Well, Brexit fears look the likely culprit, the slide coinciding with David Cameron's announcement that we're off to the polls in June for the EU referendum. Well, here's Jane Foley, senior strategist at Rabobank.
When we say that sterling has reacted to Brexit, what we really should be saying is that sterling has reacted to political uncertainty. Political uncertainty can really force a lot of investors right to the sidelines. Many people who may have been considering investing in sterling and the UK will decide really to remain out of the equation and to see what happens when the uncertainty clears.
No uncertainty for the Prime Minister, David Cameron.
We will be safer, we'll be stronger, we'll be better off inside the EU. I think the prospect of, you know, linking arms with Nigel Farage and George Galloway and taking a leap into the dark is the wrong step for our country. And if Boris and if others really care about being able to get things done in our world, then the EU is one of the ways in which we get them done.
So, Q, not inches, Nate, miles of newspaper columns, broadcasters outside Downing Street, and we've still got 4 months to go, during which time most city economists reckon the pound could fall even further. And what if we vote to leave? Armageddon. We're not far off, according to the UK trade body EEF, saying we face an abyss of uncertainty and risk. HSBC getting involved as well, predicting up to a 20% drop in value. David Buick is market commentator at Panmure Gordon.
We've got two camps here. One, government and big business, who are united. There was a comment made in the Telegraph, I think late last week, that 80% of the FTSE 100 companies' CEOs were pro-staying in Europe. I don't think that's accurate. I think it's 99%. This is a club together with all the professional advisors, accountants, lawyers, where there is some enormous fees and there is an awful lot to lose. But the other side of the coin is that we must not forget the widget makers in Wisbeach, which really create the growth of this country. I mean, most of GDP now doesn't come from FTSE 100 companies. They make the most noise because they've got the most money. God knows what their pot is in order to advertise and keep us in, but it will be millions and millions and millions. In point of fact, if you look at the FTSE 100 for itself, 70% of its income comes from dollar-related products. So why they're obsessed with this, I have absolutely no idea. Now, the City of London in the same group, because it stands to make an enormous amount of money, and the fear or scaremongering campaign is under a wet sail now, you will find that most people who work in the City of London work for very big companies, and we have pretty good evidence that these guys have been gagged and told not to say what their personal views are, but to carry the party line. We've got to make sure also that the City of London Corporation doesn't get away from its open and very neutral political stance, because it's important that it's seen as something that just gives a sense of balance to the whole occasion.
Interesting views there from David Buick, market commentator at Panmure Gordon. Now, Simon, I want to go back to a bit of an economics 101, if that's all right. What do we mean when we talk about sterling slumping against the dollar or the euro?
So what we've got is a scenario where basically the pound has fallen in value against the euro and against the dollar. So why has it done that? Well, it's basically done that because markets really don't like uncertainty. And there is an element of uncertainty at the moment. Are we going to vote to stay in, or are we going to vote ourselves out? In is, you know, nice and stable. We all know about that. We know what that looks like because that's where we are now. Out, despite the suggestions that actually Britain might do quite well, or that it wouldn't really make that much difference, that we would continue to flourish. And we talked last week about Neil Woodford's commissioned report, which basically said economically it doesn't really make that much difference either way. Despite that, out represents uncertainty. Now, if you think about, for example, two of the safest assets that you can buy, right, which are government bonds, okay, so US government bonds, treasury bills, and UK gilts. Now, if you've got a pile of money that you want to put in the safest place that you can, and bear in mind that there is a very large pile of money washing around the world that tries to find these safest places, you've got the choice of America, where basically the economy's doing pretty well, everything seems to be okay. Yes, there's a few clouds on the horizon with the election. You know, is Donald Trump going to get elected? Could that really happen? But there's a relative amount of certainty there. And also, they've recently raised interest rates, and you're looking at a scenario where interest rates should continue to go up there rather than go down. Versus, you look at the UK, where we may or may not vote ourselves in or out of what is essentially a very, very large trading block. There's a lot of uncertainty. So if you've got that big pile of money, where are you going to put it? You're going to put it in the one that looks more certain. So it goes into buying US Treasury bills, and that money helps bump up the dollar because you're buying stuff that's in dollars and you're selling stuff that's in pounds, and that helps push down the pound. And then you can extend that kind of scenario to all other kinds, lots of other kinds of assets. If you're a fund manager and you've got some money to invest, are you going to invest it in UK companies, UK banks, you know, or are you going to think, well, maybe I might hold off for the moment because I'm a little bit uncertain about what's going on here? And the more people are uncertain, the bigger the effect is.
Yeah.
And also, don't forget that these things just move in cycles and they swing around the place. And, you know, there's momentum that happens. The momentum at the moment is pushing the pound down against the dollar. At some point, that'll turn and the pound will rise against the dollar.
Well, that's it. I mean, there are predictions. We've not seen the end of the fall. We've got 4 months left of this to go. So expect it to rolling eyes there, Simon. Good for radio. But we're expecting this, obviously, to go up and down, aren't we? And then whatever happens in terms of the vote. Is this, though, something that could turn the whole debate? Is it that important, do you think?
No, I don't think it is. I think that this is a debate that really, there's a lot of stuff about business and there's a lot of stuff about economics in there. But I think that for the average person, and bear in mind that everyone gets one vote, you know, Boris doesn't get more votes than you or I. David Cameron doesn't get more votes than you or I. I think for the average person out there, this is a question about politics, and this is a question about how they feel about having a extra political body on top of our elected politicians in this country. And just to go back to the HSBC thing, they've suggested that potentially Brexit could take the pound down from, it's fallen below $1.40. They're suggesting it could take it down to $1.11. And I will just read you my quote of the week, basically, from Tom Beckett, Chief Investment Officer at the wealth management firm Sigma, who said, "The one thing investors really don't like is uncertainty. And it seems like HSBC is freaking out a little bit. Making strong predictions at this point is probably a mug's game. Sterling could fall 20%, but it could also go up to 20%. There is likely to be a lot of volatility in the lead up to the Brexit vote, but weakness is not necessarily a bad thing. A weak pound is not really something to get upset about unless you're planning on taking lots of foreign holidays."
Well, that's it. My next question was going to be very unequivocal there. Was the winners and the losers of the weak pound, and reports that the British tourism industry rubbing their hands with glee as we all decide this Easter and summer to take a staycation. Is that right, Rachel?
Yeah, if people really pay enough attention to currency movements to plan their holidays, then potentially that would be the case. We should, in theory, see a move away from European destinations, and yes, it will be cheaper for people to stay at home and also cheaper for people from abroad to come to us for their holidays. So bad news if you are planning to go abroad to Europe or to the US. Also, Lee did an interesting story today about Spain particularly being very expensive this year, because you have the double whammy of these currency movements, but also for some reason or other, people aren't so interested in going to Tunisia this year or to Egypt or to Turkey. And so they're looking around for the familiar, and what do they find? Spain. And so already destinations there are selling out. So holiday makers, good and bad news. But again, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing, the fall in sterling. The volatility is more of an issue. That kind of uncertainty is never good for investing. But lots of people argue that if the sterling depreciates, that's good news for trade. The stuff that we buy is cheaper for others to buy. They're more likely to do so. That's a bit of a boost for us. And there's been considerable movement towards readjusting our economy and towards manufacturing and creating stuff. And so that would prove a real boost.
Simon talked about politics there. I just want to know, elections, referendums in general, they do tend to shake things up, don't they, of course. Does the turmoil last very long? What are the precedents?
Well, the last two, no, we were back to normal the next day, weren't we? Scotland, back to normal. Yeah, so not necessarily. I suppose it depends if we vote to stay in, whether in is status quo, going back to completely as things were, or whether there'll be talk of an adjustment of our position in Europe following that. But in theory, should be back to how things were, but still very much beholden to Europe and what happens in Europe. We haven't had that conversation for a long time, but it's not gone anywhere. I think had we had this kind of Brexit discussion even a year ago, when we were talking every week, every Friday, we were talking about Greece and what was going to happen, and whether it raised questions about the whole kind of Europe project anyway. And that will rear its head again. So just because we vote to stay in doesn't mean that it's an end to that kind of volatility.
It's not just Britain that faces, this volatility. Surely, though, if Britain decide to leave, other countries are going to turn around and say, well, hang on a minute, or if we get a completely changed deal, and then what's that going to do to the Europe project?
Well, the cat's out of the bag a bit now, isn't it? Because whether people think David Cameron got good concessions or not, he did go over there and he did get some concessions. And, you know, the UK has been removed from this aim of the European countries, the EU countries, of closer and closer unity. We've got an out from that. It's like, so all of the countries are committed to closer and closer unity over time, apart from Britain. So what's going to happen now when someone says, well, do you know what? Actually, we like it as well, but we don't really like that. And I think that this comes down to the fundamental problem that, you know, the architects of the EU, the great supporters of the EU, the statesmen who designed it, the statesmen who have, and women who have continued it, possibly want a slightly different thing to what people, the man on the street, wants. And I think that the EU as a free trade area, free movement, go and work and live in any country you want to, buy and sell things, you know, with no extra tariffs or charges, is a great thing. But I myself have questions over the political aspect of it, loss of control over your own laws. But then the question is like with this regulation thing, we all complain about all this regulation. There was this great line in the Woodford report last week that said basically, you know, there's all these suggestions of how much money we'd save from getting rid of all these EU regulations. But the point is we'd probably keep most of them anyway, because quite a lot of them are just like common sense and things designed to make people's lives better.
We'd have no say over whether they got changed or not. We'd have to keep most of them if we wanted to continue trade with Europe, but we wouldn't have a say any longer on what they were.
Well, let's stop staring into this abyss of uncertainty and risk and take a look at your in-out poll on your website, Simon, because last time we looked, it was 82% of your readers wanted out. How is it looking now?
It has completely turned around to 22% would like to stay in and 78% want out. And that is from 14,000 people who have voted, so that's quite a lot of people. So that's an overwhelming out.
Watch out, YouGov.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Now, let's focus on the bank, shall we? And goodness, it's been a rocky start, hasn't it, for 2016. Shares falling. We're hearing this week profits down at many of the big banks, and yet more money put aside for litigation and compensation. Is this the next banking crisis, we've asked? So, as you'd expect, dividends have been cut, salaries reduced, bonuses axed altogether. No, not really. That didn't happen. So some bonuses were cut, but we did see HSBC profits down, Lloyds too, 7% fall in pre-tax profits to £1.6 billion. Lloyds also, though, paid out a record dividend and gave its boss a 6% pay rise. We'll hear from Barclays next month. Most recently, 73% government-owned RBS posting its 8th year of annual losses, working out at £2 billion. Markets commentator Chris Bailey from Financial Orbit is optimistic, though, after looking through the numbers.
The core RBS business, the business that we interact with maybe as NatWest customers and related on a day-to-day basis, is relatively stable. They call it the UK personal and banking business, and they had stable profitability last year there of just over £2 billion. And they're indicating that their net lending has actually been the strongest since 2009. Now, again, it's not showing any great growth, but the fact that you've got a relatively stable business there, a utility-like business, this is what banks are going to look like a bit more going forward. You know, this is borne out by these RBS numbers.
Well, that was specifically RBS, but what's been hurting a lot of the banks is the billions more set aside for, as I said, litigation and compensation, notably PPI, which we'll get to in a moment. But firstly, Simon, I want to know more generally what is going on here. Profits are down, we're hearing, dividends are up, bonuses still being paid. Should we be concerned, or is this an attempt by banks paying out the dividends to perhaps soothe investors?
Yes, well, with Lloyds, the suggestion for holding Lloyds is two things. You want to invest in Lloyds because you think that the UK economy will do quite well, because Lloyds is essentially a very domestically focused bank and pretty much a proxy for the UK economy. And also because you think that it will pay out dividends in the future. And you know, it has pledged to pay dividends, and there is the suggestion among city analysts that it could pay out basically about half its profits in dividends to shareholders. So you could see Lloyds move from a point where it was paying no dividends because it had to axe them after the financial crisis, back to the point where it was a share yielding, say, 4%.
Yeah.
And that would be pretty good. And it took the next step on the road to getting those dividends up by revealing a full-year dividend of 2.25p per share yesterday, but also this special dividend worth half a penny per share, which isn't a huge amount, actually. If you take that on Lloyds' share price yesterday morning, before it bounced off the back of its results, that was only a 0.8%, you know, yield, that half a penny, but it's an extra little bit on top of the dividend, and investors like that. And Lloyds shares, I did some maths here a second ago, have bounced 16% in 2 days. So if you had bought Lloyds shares on Wednesday, before the results came out, you would now be 16% up, which is pretty good.
Which makes sense, doesn't it? If you're going to get some money from them,
yes,
you want to invest in them.
Yes, it
but
does.
Is it sustainable?
Potentially, if they work towards this paying out like half their profits in dividends, that's sustainable. And when you look at a share, you need to look at whether that dividend is covered properly or whether it's being paid out of, you know, debt, borrowed money. And you need to look at the company's prospects. And if you look, for example, at some of the other big dividend payers in the FTSE, you've got the oil companies and some of the miners, commodity companies. And at the moment, people are looking at those and they think they're going to cut their dividends, whereas they're looking at Lloyds and thinking it's sorted out a lot of its problems. It's on the upward trajectory. Mm. It's probably going to raise its dividend. And, you know, the profits were down basically because they set aside yet more money for PPI. So their bill this year for setting aside money for PPI is £4 billion, basically.
Yeah, £4 billion.
£4 billion. It's a huge sum of money that they've had to set aside to pay off all this PPI. It really is. But at some point, that's going to stop. And that's also what investors are looking at. They're looking at, you know, a line being drawn under PPI. And once they've got over that, then maybe we can start getting back to a lot more of a normal style situation.
Well, we're going to PPI in a bit more detail, but also the government saying last month that it was postponed selling off some of the shares in Lloyds until the situation improves. How are we looking now? I guess better than we were.
Yeah, so this is quite funny because basically a huge number of people signed up to basically be notified when this share sale happens, even though they could just sign up anyway when it actually happens. But the government set up this special thing so you could be notified. There was a wave of people. There was a huge amount of interest in it. And basically, as part of the Lloyds share sale, people were going to get a discount. You know, buy a certain number of shares, get one free if you held them for a year. Now, the great irony is that due to the market having fallen substantially and Lloyds having taken a beating as well, the shares were at a much greater discount and have been for the last sort of month or so. So if you thought that Lloyds was a good investment at the point when the Chancellor announced that share sale and you were attracted by that discount, then you should have bought those shares when they were 16%, you know, 20% lower than they are now over the last month or so, because they were an even greater discount. But loads of people won't have bought the shares. Now they've gone back up. The question is, will he re-announce the sale? I reckon they'd probably like to do it this year, but he's going to be really wary about putting it back on the table, because what if something goes bad again and he has to take it back off the table? He's going to start looking really silly if he keeps announcing it and then taking it off the table.
Yeah, might do indeed. I want to focus also, though, on new figures out from RBS. The eighth consecutive annual loss, 73% government-owned. Debt expert Carl Packman. Now, he thinks we missed an opportunity back in 2013 with what we could do with RBS.
There's lots of tinkering, we'll say, but the plans and aims in 2013 for what we could do with RBS to make it more than just a too big to fail or a business as usual kind of bank and turn it into something that could really benefit the community. Yes, certainly. There is a bit of disappointment around that because we had really high hopes. But this was something that wasn't just discussed in circles that I knock around in, but discussed in the House of Lords. Lord Sharkey, Lord Glassman, serious players who were thinking about what RBS could become, you know, having a theoretical framework for how RBS could reemerge as a kind of community-led financial organisation. So, I mean, that hasn't happened. So,
and it's not likely to, is it?
Not likely, no. So, you know, those creative ideas were all for nothing, unfortunately.
All for nothing, Simon? What do you make of the figures from RBS?
Well, they're pretty bad. I mean, it's managed to lose £2 billion. But that's better than the £3.5 billion that it reported a year earlier, so I suppose things might be getting better. The big loss was basically partly due to a £3.6 billion charge for litigation costs, which includes £2.1 billion to cover expected legal action on US residential mortgage-backed securities, as well as £600 million extra for PPI mis-selling compensation. I mean, you have to question, like, how this whole thing costs these banks so much money, don't you? These are colossal sums of money that we are talking about. But these are the kind of, like, the sums of money we're talking about here are basically bigger than the profits of a lot of very, very big companies. I don't know. I think we missed an opportunity where we didn't just break RBS up a long time ago. I think it was so ailing. You could see the case for, like, nursing Lloyds back to health, but RBS, I think we should have just broken it up a long time ago, cut our losses.
Rachel, your views?
I always laugh at these when I see further proof of litigation and the impact on profits. With Bob Diamond, 2011, he said, time to forgive the banks, the end of banker bashing. A load of rubbish. 2016, and there's still fines to this extent. I mean, a lot of it is kind of historical, the PPI ended some time ago, but it's... the numbers are just almost hard to get your head round.
Well, here's personal finance expert Simon Reed talking about the rolling PPI effects.
Bad news for the banks, you know, but it's something they brought upon themselves. Interestingly, Lloyds has had a bigger compensation bill than all the other banks. They were one of the biggest group, to be fair, to include the Halifax Bank of Scotland, what is now TSB. But they, I think they were one of the worst. And annoyingly, they are... clearly one of the worst at dealing with complaints. And we saw figures from the Ombudsman earlier this week, which showed that 78% of complaints against Lloyds were upheld. Now, they've been accused in the past of deliberately delaying PPI payouts because they hope that people will get fed up and go away. So, of course, these people don't get fed up now because they see their friends getting £1,000 or £2,000. They take it all the way to the Ombudsman, and that the Ombudsman has to step in. Now, that's wrong. Lloyds should have cleaned this up years ago, to be honest. I think what they're relying on now is that because there's this dead end at 2018, when there's going to be no more claims, no more payouts, they're hoping that that'll be the end of it. Well, I would encourage anyone, if you haven't claimed now, get moving.
So more to be set aside if that's the case. That was personal finance expert Simon Reed there. So PPI continuing to feature heavily. We also heard, as Simon mentioned there, involvement in the foreign exchange rate manipulation. Now, one perhaps to keep an eye on, that most banks are setting aside money for, so far relatively small amounts of money, to be fair, for compensation, is in relation to packaged bank accounts. I know we've spoken about this in the past on this show. Barclays and Lloyds have both done so recently, RBS putting aside £100 million for compensation. It does seem a smaller amount of money when you think about how much we're paying out for PPI. But then if you remember a few years back, the banks thought just a couple of billion would cover PPI. And we're now at, what, £22 billion, Rachel? So the packaged bank accounts, is that the next PPI? I know we've asked that question.
We're always looking out for the next mis-selling scandal, aren't we? And this is one that has potential. So the idea is that package accounts come with a bundle of different things. It might be car insurance, might be health insurance, phone insurance. Sometimes you get access to airport lounges, things like that. The problem is, if you couldn't use some of those products, but you're still paying for them essentially, then have you been missold them? That's the question. So if you were paying for health insurance, for example, but you were, you know, 85 years old and the cap for health insurance was 70, then, well, you missold that. If you're paying for phone insurance and didn't have one, if you're paying for car insurance but didn't have a car, that's the question. And, yeah, it remains to be seen whether that becomes an issue that's considered by regulators more seriously. The other one that's been talked about this week again by the National Audit Office, and it was picking up on something that had been mentioned already by the Financial Conduct Authority, is around pension reforms.
Which we will be speaking about very shortly. But I do want to ask one final question on this before we move on to pensions, Rachel. And Simon, stripping the litigation, the compensation away from these figures, is what is left to good banks trying to build their reputation, move on from the sins of their past, restructure, or should we be perhaps more concerned?
Lloyds, I think, yes, probably a decent prospect. I have, like many people in the country, I have some Lloyds shares dating back so many years ago when Halifax demutualised. and then they were HBOS shares, and then they became Lloyds shares when there was the arranged marriage. I've held on to them. I think that they've got further to go. And maybe I'm kicking myself I didn't buy some more over the past month, as I talked about a minute ago. RBS, I wouldn't buy shares in RBS right now. I still think it's too much of a basket case. It's getting better, but I still think it's too much of a basket case. I think all of those sins of the past are continuing to haunt it too much.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
Hello, I'm Sarah Lowther, presenter of Morning Money, the breakfast show that brings you the breaking business, economic and political stories that set the agenda for the day ahead. Join myself and our industry experts from 6 till 9 every weekday morning. Morning Money, topical, informative, reliable, relevant, interactive.
This is Share Radio.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio with me in partnership with NS&I for our weekly catch-up in the studio. Editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Now, coming up, fancy a nice little cash windfall? We reveal the organisations that could owe you money and, importantly, how to claim it. But first, anyone think there is a budget coming up? The amount of speculation we're seeing about changes to our pensions. Oh, yeah. There is. As the Chancellor scrambles around the back of the Treasury sofa looking for money to cut the deficit, there's much speculation his hands could be about to grip and even strangle the whole principle of pension saving. Could we see the end of the tax-free lump sum? Will a flat rate for tax relief be introduced? If so, how low? 20, 25, 30%? George Osborne isn't shy to shaking things up. Remember the pension freedoms.
Well, we have these major new reforms to pensions and new freedoms for people saving for their retirement. It's all part of us supporting people who save and work hard and trusting them with their own money. And, of course, people want to get the right advice and guidance. Make sure you get the right guidance and advice. Take your time if you need time to make the decision. Make the most of these really fundamental changes we're making to ensure we give people freedom and choice and we build an economy based on savings, not on debt.
Well, Scottish MP Mary Black summed up the displeasure at some of the changes that we might be hearing about.
Pensions are not a benefit, yeah, they are a right. Mm-hmm. One of my constituents described them as a contract, and that's exactly what they are. Yeah. So let me make this very simple. Everybody in here has a phone. In fact, iPads that some people will be sitting on right now. We have a contract. If O2 or Virgin or whoever else, 3, were to change the terms and conditions of our contract, we would have something to say about it. And if they waited 14 years to tell us that the terms and conditions had changed, I'm sure that everybody in here would have something to say about it. And if they said, on top of that, you're also going to be forced to live off your life savings because of the changes of that contract, you would be up in arms about it, and quite rightly so. So why are pensions any different here?
Here, here.
Pulling no punches there, Mary Black, Scottish MP. But there are fears all these changes, putting the funds in the hands of savers themselves rather than more experienced and regulated pension funds, could leave us prey to exploitation and bad deals. The National Audit Office, as Rachel was suggesting earlier, says it's on high alert for scams in this sector. And the Financial Conduct Authority have also warned that inexperienced savers could get taken advantage of. So lots of speculation, Rachel, first of all, over these changes. Firstly, what are the big worries that people are talking about? None of these have come in yet.
No, we still don't know. But the fear is that by the time we do know, it might be too late. So we're doing lots of worrying now. The fear is that pensions relief is worth about £34 billion a year. And Osborne's feeling a little bit short of cash. Mm-hmm. This is an obvious thing to go for. No matter how it's dressed up as a positive thing for some savers or people on lower incomes, the pot is going to reduce. So there will be people who will miss out some way or other. Most likely still we're thinking is that we'll have a flat rate of pensions relief. So it won't be based on your income as it is at the moment. So if you're a 20% tax rate payer, you get that back at the moment. If you pay 40%, you get that back, and 45%. So it could be a flat rate, or it could be this thing that everyone is very worried about, which is a pension ISA.
So what's a pension ISA?
So it turns the whole idea of pension saving on its head. No longer would you get tax relief when you put money into your pension, but you would pay no tax when it comes out of your pension at the other end. Assuming, by the way, that you have a government who honours that when it comes time for you to retire. Who knows?
What is the likeliest scenario, Simon, do you think, of all the options on the table here? Indeed, nothing?
I think the likeliest scenario is a flat rate, basically. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, because I think that the principle of tax-free pension saving that dates back to 1921 is one that's worth defending and keeping. And I think the best option for George Osborne would be to do nothing. But I don't think that he will take that option. I think he will go for a flat rate. And as Rachel said, it's basically to save money. And you have to remember that the reason why George Osborne is having to do this is because he says he needs to save the money. Now, the
it's
only
his
reason
own
he
promise,
needs to
isn't
save
it?
The money is because he made the promise to balance the books by 2020. And his promise to balance the books by 2020 is probably a good promise because we do need to balance our books. But do we need to balance our books at the expense of the pensions of a generation of people who are already going to have much worse pensions than their parents' generation and are already struggling with much higher house prices and wages that aren't going up and all those other things? Or should we just relax the promise a little bit and say, well, there's this stuff that we need to balance the books on, you know, the spending element of the stuff that, you know, are we spending our money wisely? And then there's also this other bit, which is the money that the reason why we use this money is because this is for the long-term good. And I think that that pension tax relief principle is the kind of the bit that's for the long-term good. And bear in mind as well, A, he said 2020, which is a completely arbitrary date, apart from the fact that we happen to have an election in that year. You know, that's the only reason it's 2020, not 2022, not 2025 or anything like that. And also, the UK's borrowing costs are almost as low as they have ever been. OK, now that is no reason to apply some credit card logic to the whole thing and go, oh, don't worry about it. We're just making the minimum payment. It's fine kind of thing. But it does mean that, you know, we can afford to give ourselves a bit of leeway on stuff that is for the long term good. And by stuff that's for the long term good, I mean stuff like pensions, schools, hospitals, infrastructure, the things that we need in this country.
We have to talk about politics. I mean, you suggested there he might be unlikely to do nothing, but in the shadow, and let's go full circle of this hugely divisive Brexit debate, I'm only talking about the Conservative Party here, not the rest of the country, plus, of course, sort of the silver vote, as we talk about, is a chance of really going to make a decision that will prove so hugely unpopular with the Conservative grassroots, Rachel?
Well, he didn't mind doing it with buy-to-let. I mean, there is really a fear there, and it depends how he can sell it. So if he can sell it as a sort of buy one, get one free, is it one for one, two for one deal, then that helps lower income earners, well, then perhaps that sells. And the Sun's taken that line recently. I think, maybe he'll get away with it if he sells it in the right way.
Well, just to say that there is the sort of the flat rate thing, but the nuclear option that's being talked about is this pension ISA thing.
Yeah.
And the reason why this was back in the news this week was because of this discussion that it would remove one of the great pension perks, which is the tax-free lump sum. So when you take your pension, you can basically take up to 25% of the pot as one big tax-free lump sum, which a lot of people like to do. And that will, if you've got a defined contribution pension, that will leave less in your pot to generate an income with. Or if you have a final salary pension, that will reduce the income that you're going to get paid by your former employer. Now, if we move to a pension ISA, then we would lose this tax-free lump sum. And part of that, you think, well, duh, because if all the money is tax-free on the way out, of course we'd lose the tax-free lump sum. But the crucial thing about the tax-free lump sum is it's this chunk of your pension savings that is totally tax-free, because you get the tax relief on the way in and then you get this tax-free bit on the way out. And that makes this really great chunk of your pension savings. If we switch to the pension ISA system, you'll get taxed on the way in, be taxed on the way out. So actually, that really good chunk will lose one of its key benefits. And actually, someone was talking to me the other day and saying there's an even more nuclear option, which is basically there's a thing called salary sacrifice, which instead of you making your pension payments and then claiming the tax relief back from the government, you basically forfeit some of your salary and then your employer pays that directly into your pension, mm-hmm. so you never pay tax on it. Now, the great benefit of that is you don't pay national insurance as well. Also, it's a benefit for companies because they save on some of the national insurance. Now, the nuclear option is George Osborne pushes ahead with merging national insurance and income tax, or axes salary sacrifice altogether.
Or just scraps pensions altogether, just, you know, why not? That'd
yeah.
be the nuclear option,
yeah.
Before we move on, one final thing we did mention, or you mentioned there, Rachel, about the National Audit Office saying it's on high alert for scams in the pension sector. Has something new happened, particularly now that it's come out and said this?
It's just sort of as pension freedoms start to settle down and we see what the fallout is, attention's being paid to. There's sort of two things. There's all-out scams, so people trying to nick your nest egg off you. And then there's mis-selling, which is selling you investments that may not be appropriate. It's a whole new group of people who have access to a huge sum of money that is absolutely everything to them. And to make sure that people have the right kind of guidance to make the best decisions for them is very difficult.
This is Money, award-winning finance website, back in the studio for our weekly country. We'll be focusing on property now. Now, we've been hearing a lot in the news about the woes of first-time buyers, haven't we? But they're not the only ones. Second stepper, over 40, then bad luck. All that coming up first. Does your house earn more than you do? I ask because in some cases, homes are rising in value so fast they're actually earning more than their owners. Research by Halifax shows the average prices have increased by more than the average employee's earnings. Martin Ellis is head of housing economics at Halifax and spoke to Share Radio.
It is actually very regionalised, but it's very much concentrated in London, the southeast and east of England. Places in those three regions comprise 90% of all the areas where this phenomenon has been the case in the last couple of years. So it's very much concentrated in London and the southeast. And I guess that's not surprising given that that's where house prices have risen most sharply, particularly over the last two or three years. The market's certainly very cyclical and we do see these big swings in house prices, but we don't see much evidence of there being any sort of long-term narrowing in the north-south divide. In fact, it does tend to be the reverse. Clearly, we did have a downturn in the housing market between 2007 and 2009, but as the market's recovered again, it has been led by the south of England. That's where we've seen the strongest gains. And that's really been the picture for the last two or three years. We're now seeing rises across the rest of the country, but it's very much being led by London and the southeast again. And that partly reflects the fact that that part of the UK economy has been the strongest. It's been the healthiest part of the UK. And that's where sort of earnings are highest. And it's also more attractive, for example, for overseas buyers as well. So you're putting those factors together, and yes, we're seeing the same old trend.
Well, that was Martin Ellis, head of housing economics at Halifax. But can this situation continue? A report from Santander claims house prices could double in 15 years. It comes as we're hearing a sharp rise in the number of over 40 struggling to get a mortgage due to their age. Over 40, it's not exactly old, especially when the age of a first-time buyer has gone up to 31 and we're living longer. Plus, while all the focus has been on the first-time buyer, it seems the plight of the so-called second stepper has been ignored. So, Simon, you've looked into this, particularly this Santander report. Are homes earning more than we do? House prices doubling in 15 years? Is this likely?
It's not completely outlandish. It sounds outlandish. And I must admit, when we first saw this report, me and Rachel both said, nah, it's not going to happen. But actually, when I looked into it and you look at the maths behind it, it could happen. I don't think it will, but it could happen. But just to reflect on the house earning more than you think, there's a great comment from one of our readers, TR33 in Birmingham, who said, "My house earns me nothing unless I sell it and make myself homeless." which is a very good point. And this plight of the second steppers thing, so it's getting harder and harder to move home. It's not just about first-time buyers. It's about everyone. Everyone is finding it harder and harder to move home, and that is reflected in the low level of transactions and the low number of properties for sale. Mm. People just, they don't move. They're like, well, I could move, but it's going to cost me X amount of money to move. Then there's the stamp duty, and then there's the high price of houses. And you can look at it as your house earning more than you, or you can look at it as that house that you'd like to move to, that extra bedroom that you'd like to get, that bigger garden that you'd like to get, is getting further and further out of reach, that it, you know, it's accelerating much quicker than your wages. And to go back to this Santander report, I did some number crunching. House prices will double in 15 years, from an average of just under £285,000 in 2015 to almost £560,000 by 2030, so says the Santander report, compiled by an LSE professor, Paul Cheshire. But a lot of that's just the magic of compounding. In order to do that, house prices would only need to rise by 4.6% a year over the next 15 years. And that's not beyond the realms of possibility. And it's actually below the long-term trend, which is about 8%. The only thing I would say is houses are about as expensive versus wages as they have ever been. So everything that I know about economics and money and investing and finance tells me that they are expensive and they cannot keep going up and they will not double in 15 years and that you're looking at a point where they won't double from. But I have been so wrong on this for so many years that there is every chance they will more than double in 15 years.
But don't we need to, as well, we just need to build some more? I mean, the government did say this week that building new homes is up, but still 22% below the pre-crisis peak. Rachel, what are your thoughts about this? And particularly throwing in, like Simon says there, everybody seems to be struggling. It's stagnating. Nobody's moving up. Nobody's moving on. And now we're hearing over 40s are struggling to get mortgages. 40s?
It's frightening, isn't it? It's just going to get harder and harder if things continue as they are to get onto the property ladder. It's utterly feasible that you wouldn't be able to build up a deposit. The average is, what, 30-something grand? To be able to build that up before the age of 40. Plus, you've got students now coming out with debt of about 45 grand easily. It's going to be impossible for those people to get on the property ladder as quickly as people have been in the past. House building will go some way, so long as we sort of build the right sorts, ones that people can afford. But just thinking about this average house price of 500 something grand, who on earth would be able to buy that? If you take a deposit of generous 10%, and then if you think about what you'd have to be earning in order to be able to get a mortgage on that, I don't know where these people are going to be coming from. We see the sort of a real slowdown at the top of the market, people who in the past have been able to, foreign investors, we've got China, Malaysia, Russia, these economies all suffering, the market sort of moving out of those areas. So the sort of high-end properties that we're talking about at higher prices, there won't be the same level of competition. Hopefully that might feed down, who knows?
Who knows indeed. Now for our final two stories, getting cash for nowt. We've spoken about PPI, haven't we? 12 million people have received a cash windfall as a result, but you may be owed money elsewhere. This Is Money says staggering amounts of cash lies unclaimed in many British companies and financial institutions, like banks, energy suppliers, even the taxman. So the big question is, are you eligible for any of this? And importantly, how can we claim it? Simon, tell us more, please.
Well, you might be owed some money. Good news. Have you had an accident that wasn't your fault?
Please call This Is Money.
You had a loan. You may have some PPI. No, we've taken a far more sensible look at this. In fact, Rachel has taken a much more sensible look at this. And she has identified 14 organisations that could owe you money. And I would highly recommend that people go and look through this and have a look at them and think, do any of these people owe me money? And if they do, get the money off them.
All right, so do go on there. We don't have time for all 14, but were there any that sort of surprised you, Rachel, when you took a look at this?
Well, I put the list together because I just kept thinking of more and more places where people say, oh, you must check. The big one, I think, banks and building societies, often accounts sort of go missing. If they don't hear from you for a while, then they close the account. But the money doesn't go anywhere. It goes into this pot. And since 2013, £645 million has been rescued by their owners from this pot. So that's a really good one to go for. Then there's the easy ones. PPI, I know we go on about it, but there's still, I mean, the banks are still worried that there's a huge pot still to be claimed. Funny ones, like if you have someone due to come and take a meter reading and they don't turn up on time, was 20 quid, not bad, may as well.
You've also got train companies, electricity distributors. Do you give advice on how you can get the money, how you can find out if you're owed the money for some cases?
So in the story on thisismoney.co.uk, I give an explanation, I think, for each one on how you do it. All of these pots, the whichever company organisation it is, they are obliged to give you that money back. A lot of them are really trying to track down people, so they say, to give it back because they can't spend it on anything else. So they do try and make it as easy as possible for you to claim it. So in a lot of cases, it'll be the matter of a phone call or an email. You never know, worth a go.
Simon?
I think my favourite one here is an unclaimed premium bonds prize.
Yep.
I do. Now, the reason why this is my favourite is because this happens to people when they move house and things like that. But basically, not only will you track down the premium bond that you own, which is worth money, but it might have won something as well. It's a double win.
It is indeed. Final thing before I let you go. We were speaking about loyalty cards, weren't we, last week, and whether they're worth bothering with anymore, with so many companies cutting their rewards scheme. So how do you still get money for essentially nothing when shopping, particularly online? And you reckon you've discovered a secret way to get discount codes when shopping online. What is it?
Well, I think they're awful. When you're shopping on a website and a little thing comes up saying, would you like any help? And it's some sort of customer service person. But the message here, this is Tara Evans looked into it for us, don't dismiss it. If you chance it, ask for a discount code. Chances are you'll get one. You've just got to ask for it. The advice is maybe try a bit of small talk first, or at least sort of, you know, look like you're big, friendly and honestly are going to buy this item. And then just ask for a discount code.
I'm reckoning, Simon, you're not going to do that.
Chat them up and then ask for some money off. That's brilliant. Also, just before we go, one of our reporters, Becky, had a great tip this week as well in an interview she did where she said, basically, if you want to buy some stuff, basically put it in your basket, then just leave it in the online basket, go away and come back a day later and you might find that you've been offered some form of discount.
Not a bad tip. Editor Simon Lambert, Personal Finance. Editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss, thank you so much for joining us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.